Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2013. Lecture 19, delivered on October 30, 2013. The title of this lecture is Capital Structure Basics.
Today, Capital Structure Basics. This is more or less just some formulas that you have to learn. They're not hard formulas, they're very straightforward. But what's important about this is not the formulas, but what comes out of these formulas and what it tells us about a company's leverage, if you will, in several different dimensions. Let me just start you with an example here, and I'll do one that's real simple so that the numbers should come out fairly clean, although I can't guarantee that. Let's say that we have a base year and we have 1 year out. And I'm going to do this real very simply. Revenues for the base year and $12,000. And 1 year out, 1 year later, the revenues have gone up to $14,400. Now let's say that I'm just going to take away less expenses, and that will include fixed and variable expenses. Less expenses, and let's say that on the base year, well, excuse me, we're going to take out $2,000 on the base year of expenses, and on the out year, we're going to take out $2,800 in expenses. So that our earnings before interest and taxes on the base year would be $10,000, and our EBIT on the out year would be really $11,600. Nothing hard about that. Now let's take out our interest expense. We'll ignore taxes here and our net income. Well, we'll get that to that. Okay, our EBIT. We're going to take out our interest expenses, which were starting out at, let's say, $2,500. And in the that was for the base year. And for the out year, we're going to say that that interest expense has risen to $3,750. So on the base year, our earnings before taxes are going to be $7,500. And then on the out year, they'll be 15 minus 7. Please make sure my numbers are right here. 7,850. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay. And then we'll take out our taxes. Let's say tax at 15%. And 15% of 7,500 is going to be $1,125. And then 15% of $7,850. Is $1,178, rounding it to the nearest dollar. So we work out, we've got for the base year, net income is going to come out to be $7,500 minus $1,125 is $6,300. $75, and for 1 year out, $78.50 less $1,178 is going to be $66.72. No big thing there, just real simple income statement, profit and loss statement. Nothing fancy about that. What we want to do is see if we can get a little relatively straightforward, simple measure of where the big volatility movers are. We're going to use a measure called the degree of operating leverage, DOL, degree of operating leverage. Percent change in EBIT over the percent change in sales or revenue. And then we're going to do what's called the DFL, the degree of financial leverage. Which is the percent change in net income over the percent change in EBIT. And finally, we're going to do the degree of combined leverage, which is the percent change in net income divided by the percent change in sales. The degree of combined leverage measures how much the volatility is magnified from sales down to net. It tells us basically what, for every dollar change in sales, what's the effect in terms of dollar change on net income? Here's how you do it. The way to do this, and this will be on your second exam. One, it won't be any more complicated than this, really. But here's how you do it probably the most efficiently. What you're going to need is you're going to need three numbers. You're going to need the percent change in sales. You're going to need the percent change in EBIT, and you're going to need the percent change in net income. You're going to need those three for the formula. So you might as well just get them done right away and then just push them into the formula. So for percent change in sales, remember how you do that. 1440, 14,400, the end minus the beginning, 12,000. Over the beginning, 12,000. So percent change in sales would be 14,400 minus 12,000, all of that divided by 12,000. Remember how you do those percent changes? I showed you that early in the semester, back when we were all young and happy and in love and all that. Okay, EBIT, percent change in EBIT. You just do the same thing. The ending EBIT, which is 11,600, minus the beginning EBIT, which was 10,000, all divided by the beginning EBIT, which was 10,000. I'm doing all the formulas first, and then I'll go back and calculate each of them. It's just kind of an efficiency thing. Now for the percent change in net income. Percent change in net income would be the ending net income, 66.72, minus the beginning income, net income, 63.75, all divided by the beginning net income, 63.75. Now, we're just doing the math of it. It's just arithmetic formulas right now. And then we get to do the part where we're actually finding out what if this tells us something interesting. So going back through the meat grinder on this, your percent change in sales were 14,400 minus 12,000, all of that divided by $12,000.
and make sure that you get it too.
I get 20%. Is that right? Okay, 20%. So in other words, our sales increased by 20%. Now let's see what our EBIT increased by. So we're going to do the next one, percent change in EBIT, which would be $11,600 minus $10,000, all divided by $10,000. And that changed by 16%. So our EBIT didn't change as much. And now percent change in net income. It can go either way. Okay, now the percent change in net income. So we're going to say, okay, 6672 minus 6375. All of that divided by 6375. I get 4.64%. Is that right? 4.64%. 4.66%, I guess, rounding. 4.66%. So notice in this company, and it would be different for different companies, your changes are actually getting smaller as you go down the line. But we're not done yet. We've got to do these DOLs, DFLs and DCLs. The DOL would be the percent change in EBIT, 16%, divided by the percent change in sales, 20%. 16 divided by 20 is 0.80 times. These are factors. Net income over EBIT. Net income over EBIT, which would be 4.66% divided by 16%. Is that right? Yeah, 16%. Well, that... 4.66% divided by... That was unexpected. Divided by 16%. So we come up with, survey says, 0.29 times. And then the one that is the most interesting, what happened to volatility from the top to the bottom? We would have the percent change in net income, 4.66%, divided by the percent change in sales, 20%. We get, let me write the numbers down for you here, so your notes can be complete on this, 4.66% divided by 20%. Is 0.23 times. So in other words, there was a demagnification. In this company, there was a demagnification of risk, of volatility, from the top to the bottom. For every dollar change in sales, what this last number says, follow with me. What this number says, for every $1 change in sales, the net income changed by 23 cents. That's kind of an important thing to us in business. When my sales go up or down, what is the effect on the bottom line? In this case, a dollar change in sales means a 23 cent change in my net income, my profit. In this company, then, there is essentially a compression of risk. Some companies would have a number bigger than one, like a 1.6 for the DCL, the degree of combined leverage. Like if I had a DCL, let's say I had a DCL of 1.25. Say I had a DCL of 1.25 times. If I saw that in a company, I'd say, okay, every dollar change in sales creates a dollar and a quarter change in my net, my profit. So there would, in this case, of a company like that, there would be a magnification of volatility from top to bottom. In the company that I've just done here, there's a demagnification. This would probably be, interestingly enough, what would you think about the beta? Could you say anything, just a guess about what the beta would be of the company I just showed by example here? What would you? Is there anything you might want to just take a stab, a guess at? Yeah. Lower than what? One point. Yeah. Now, we don't know that. But I would guess that this is a company that is not wildly affected by the economic circumstances. It's got some, essentially, the swings in sales don't translate that hard to the bottom line. And you'll see it all over the board. Some companies have DCLs like this, 0.23 times. Some DCLs, I've seen DCLs as high as 2.5 times or more than that. But here's the upshot. Then we ask this question, okay, what is causing the change from the top to the bottom? And so we go and we look at this. It turns out that the degree of combined leverage is the degree of operating leverage times the degree of financial leverage. Check it out. See if it's true. 0.23 should equal 0.80 times 0.29. Oh, I hope to God it does. 0.8 times 0.29. Oh, thank God. Yeah, it does. It does. Okay, now, we can say, okay, we now know what the change is from the top at sales to the bottom at net income. What were the contributing factors to this? What increased the volatility or pushed it upward? And what suppressed the volatility? What pushed it downward? Okay? And in a case like this, I can say, okay, the volatility was pushed downward by both of these in this case. But in this company's case, if I'm looking at it, the volatility was helped downward more by the fact that it didn't have a lot of interest expense. It was pushed upward by its operating expenses. So let me give you another example here. Suppose that I gave you a company, and its DOL was 1.85, the DFL was 0.75, and the DCL was 1.39. I'd worked out the numbers, and this is what it came out to be. Now, the decision makers in the company are going to say, okay, we've got a company now. We have a company where every dollar change in sales creates $1.39 in net income change. So when the sales go down by a dollar, our profit goes down by $1.39. When our sales go up by a dollar, our profit goes up by $1.39. And then the question is, why? So we'd say, okay, 1.39 equals 1.85 times 0.75. If you work those out, there will be some rounding error in there. But that's basically what it says. Okay. Well, in other words, the magnification is definitely the result of our operating expenses. This is a company that is being the sales dollars are being changed strongly by our fixed costs, our buildings, our plant and equipment, that kind of stuff. And it is actually being suppressed, that is being controlled by our interest expense. It's being pushed downward. There are some companies that have this policy. The thinking goes like this. These two numbers should not be working too far against each other, unless there's a really good reason. We should not be using low debt levels to control high fixed expense levels. We should not be using low fixed expense levels to control for high interest expense levels. They shouldn't have to, one should not have to correct for the other, unless we've got some real good reason for that to be the case. They should be about in a balance. Now, that's one theory of capital structure. So in other words, in this company, we probably are keeping our debt low just because we have to have a way to control all of these fixed costs we have that are causing volatility in our net income. So the question would be, is there a way that we can correct that? Well, on the one hand, we could take on more debt and less equity, try to rebalance that way, but that would solve that number, bring it up some. But what does that do for this number? We still have these high fixed costs. Why do we have fixed costs? Are they necessary, or is this just, you know, is this just our business, or is there some way we could bring down these fixed costs? Here's how companies do it, and I've already mentioned this before. Well, let me ask you, how are companies bringing down fixed costs? What is a popular solution these days to bringing down your fixed costs in your corporation?
Outsourcing.
Send it overseas, send it to someone else to do. That way it is no longer your fixed cost, it becomes just another variable cost. You pay the company over there to make your stuff, it's not your plant and equipment, it's some other company's plant and equipment. We're also seeing this not just in corporate America, but we're seeing it in public finance as well in the United States, believe it or not. One thing, there was a speaker last night, one of the senior vice presidents of REIT's Real Estate Investment Trust for U.S. Trust, which is a division of Bank of America. He was talking about all the different REITs, in other words, these giant corporations that buy up property and then they manage it. Okay, it started out when REITs were authorized by Congress. The REITs were mostly just buying shopping malls, retail establishment places, apartment complexes, things like that. And then they got into other lines of business. Now you will see REITs that buy forests or lease forest land so that they can chop down all the trees and then dump the land back off into the market. REITs for about anything you could think of that's real property. But they've gotten into a new business now, too. And it's kind of, I sat back and I was a little unfamiliar with this last night, and I thought, really? One of the popular ones now is buying up REITs that buy a private prison property. In other words, governments are now moving prisoners and prisons to the private sector, outsourcing it. And so these REITs are now, some of them are actually specializing in just buying up the real estate of these private prisons so that they are the owners and managers of the private prison industry. You see how that is related to this? The government is getting out of a massive fixed cost business. Prisons are just a massive infrastructure thing. And so the government simply gets out of the business of the fixed costs of those and moves it to something else. And then they pay them, the prison management companies like CCCI and all of those, to take care of the business, to handle it. It's an outsourcing. You're seeing outsourcing in other areas of public finance as well. Two areas I'll bring up. where it's happening in, not, it's again, I'm trying to emphasize, this isn't just corporate America that's doing it. This is a real phenomenon, and you're seeing why it's done, getting rid of those fixed costs. One area where the government is moving out and letting private industry in is in space exploration, and specifically space exploitation. Moving the cost, the fixed, incredible fixed costs, to private industry. For first tourism, but then for mining of the asteroids and all that kind of stuff. Another area where you're seeing it very much in the background is in military, where we are essentially moving the fixed costs of maintaining massive military presences in countries we occupy to private companies that will take care of it for us. We don't have the fixed costs of maintaining a standing army and all of that. We just move it to private industry. And then for us, for the public, it's a variable cost, and the private industries take on the fixed costs of keeping these force levels high. So as we move out of Iraq, Afghanistan, we're just moving the public sector out, and we're moving in the private mercenary armies and then paying them to take care of the business. And it also takes away the accountability so that we don't have questions being asked about the things we're doing. That's all about this. It's all about this. It's simply trying to say, how do we keep this magnification down? How do we keep this from happening? Okay, we look at the two factors. There is a factor of leverage of our debt. How much are we leveraging our sales with debt, and how much are we leveraging our sales off our fixed assets? So if we want to bring down our volatility, control that risk, then we have two ways to do it. Bring down our fixed costs, bring down our debt. If we bring down our debt, we're changing our capital structure towards equity, which, remember, is expensive to do. It's not that simple. Oh, yeah. We'll bring down our debt level. Now, that might not be such a good idea, because then you make it more expensive on the equity side. And on the other end, we could also bring down our fixed costs. Well, how are we going to bring down our fixed costs? We outsource. We move that risk to some company that actually wants that risk. That's the whole idea of risk transfer and derivatives of all kinds. Just moving the risk to who wants it. That is all there is to this whole leverage thing. And I'll ask one of these questions on the exam, and I'll also ask you, all right, what is this company? Where do you see the problem with volatility? Or is there a problem with volatility? If so, what is it? Now I'm going to take you over to another thing, which is also has to do with risk. In economics, you learn what sounds like it's all kind of theoretical and all and such, but it is actually out there, and we have to pay attention to it very carefully in business. That's why we like to joke about economics and economists, but we also have to pay attention to them, especially for the basics. Look, you are finally going to live your dream. You don't want to do, you know, like corporate life, work in a cubicle your whole life. You want to do what you had always wanted, the thing you had since you were a child. You wanted to make and sell dried flower arrangements at county fairs. And you finally said, enough of this college stuff, I'm going to live my dream. Okay, so you go out there and you get yourself all set up. Now, there are going to be two things that go on when you make those baskets. You've got to make them, but then you've got to sell them. And price is going to be one of your problems. Of course, you've got to figure out how much to do for a dried flower range. But you also have to make them. You call up suppliers. And you find out, well, yeah, okay, I can buy the dried flowers, the baskets, the ribbons. And, of course, we do also want to add some fragrance to them to make it tasteful. We may live among savages, but we have to be civilized ourselves. And so you find out that there are these costs to make one dried flower arrangement basket. The costs altogether to make one of them would, let's say, be $2.50, buying the baskets in China and using slave labor from Mexico to pick up the, to get the dried flower arrangements, stealing them off public land for your robber baron capitalist needs. So each one of these baskets will cost you $2.50. You make no baskets, there's no cost. You make one basket, there's $2.50. You make two baskets, there are $5 in costs. These are what we would call variable costs because they vary directly with the number of baskets you make. Now, in accounting and finance, we have another name for these, but it's the same idea. Do you know what we would call this? What would you call this? We don't call it the economics term variable cost. What do we call it in finance or in accounting? What is the cost that you can directly attribute to a product? It sounds like there's a disconnect there, but yeah, that's just your, in our terminology in business, it's called cost of goods sold. But you also find out something rather disturbing. If you want to sell your dried flower arrangements at county fairs, you're going to have to rent space. And I'll actually use an actual number for you. Have any of you ever been to Third Sunday here in this area? Yeah, Third Sunday. I used to go there just to buy cheapo special stuff. Now I've been there a few times selling my stuff too. It's $125 for the space. It's $125. That is what we call a fixed cost, because it doesn't matter whether I sell one basket, or a million baskets, it's still going to be that cost. I have to pay it. It's fixed. I tell you, it was like this first, the one, I found out that really was a stupid idea. I just wanted to do it just to see what it was like to sell at that thing. And it turned out, you know, people who go to flea markets to buy cheap stuff, they don't go there to buy a couple $100 items. But anyway, so the costs of the total cost, the total cost for you to be able to sell your product would be $2.50 times the quantity of them that you make and sell. Let's say that you make exactly enough to sell, plus your $125. That's just going to be there, whether you sell anything or not. So in economics, you will see total cost equals variable cost plus fixed cost. Now let's talk about the happy thing, your profit. Your profit, if you hadn't figured this out already, is your revenue minus your costs. Not complicated. How much you take in minus how much you pay out. So that's your profit right there. Well, now your profit is going to be the price you charge times the number of items you charge, you sell. Price you charge times the number of your baskets you sell. Minus your total cost, which would be the sum of variable cost plus fixed cost. So putting that down, profit equals price times quantity minus the minus in parentheses your variable cost per unit. And I'll make that as a V, variable cost per unit, times the quantity you sell plus your fixed cost. I don't want to bore you with the arithmetic of this, but profit is price times quantity minus your variable cost times quantity minus your fixed cost. One last step here. In other words, your profit is going to be your price, your quantity times your price per unit minus your variable cost per unit minus your fixed cost. Stop right there for it, let you write that down. Nothing complicated here, really. A term I'll bring up because I want to bring this, say this, and I should warn you about this. This little thing in parentheses, this is your unit price minus your unit variable cost. The old term, and you might end up in a business where they still use the old term, this P minus V, your unit price minus your unit variable cost, we used to call that unit margin. I don't know where the term came from, but we always called it unit margin. It's actually kind of a useful thing. Notice that with a higher price, your unit margin widens. With a higher variable cost per unit, your unit margin narrows. And one of the tricks is to try to keep these as far apart from each other as possible in the work. So now let's, one last thing. How many units would I have to sell to break even? In other words, to get to a zero profit. Because I'm going to get eaten up right away by this fixed cost. You see how you're out $125 right off the bat going into the show. And you're going to crawl out of that $125 hole by every sale that you make. One sale at a time, you'll crawl out of the hole. So you're down, you're negative profit starting out the day. So we want to know how many would you have to sell to be able to crawl out of your hole. That's called break even. Break even, which we call designate Q sub BE, is the quantity where the profit gets to be zero. So in other words, we would like to know how many units we have to sell to get to a profit of zero. Because we're in negative profit with our first units we sell. And as I said, every time you sell a unit, you're crawling up out of that $125 hole that you're in. Okay, now we're back to you. What do you want to charge for your baskets? I mean, you can't charge a lot because these are people who buy baskets. You're not going to sell baskets to rich people. But you can't charge less than, obviously, you can't charge less than $2.50 a piece because you wouldn't cover it. Tell me, what are you going to charge?
Let's charge $4.
Damn, you capitalist pig. Yeah, that's actually a decent price. Yeah, it's not 100% unit margin, but it's not bad. Okay, so what we're going to do here is this. Let me rearrange this algebraically a little bit. Fixed cost is Q break even times P minus V. So the fixed cost over the unit margin is your break even quantity. Just rearranging it a little bit so that I can get the QBE by itself to see what it is. So you are going to charge $4 per basket. Our variable cost per unit is $2.50. And our fixed cost per unit is $2.50. And our fixed cost per unit is about $125. So here we go. Excuse me. Q break even for your operation is going to be our fixed cost, $125, over our unit margin, which is $4. Minus $2.50, which is $125 over a unit margin of $1.25. Is that right? No, $1.50. It's no wonder I can't run a business without driving into the ground, for God's sake. Okay, whatever. 125 divided by 1.5. is 83.3 units. So in other words, the answer you give me, he's not going to sell a third of a basket. So the answer you give me is 84 units. That's the answer you give me, 84 units. Don't give me decimal units for this because it doesn't make any sense. You're not going to chop a basket into three parts and sell the three parts. Okay, this is simple analysis, but trust me, it's actually, I do it myself. I'm going to show you a quick, dirty version of it for my own company. But okay, now let's talk about this. Let's talk about this. What do you think of that? That's right. That's bad. So what do you have to do? If you don't want to sit there all day hoping to God you sell 84 just so you zero your profit, what are you going to have to do? Bingo. This is where we begin to say, all right, reality check. Reality check. What is this telling me about what I'm going to have to do to make a profit in this? And if you see 83 and you say, there is just no way I'm going to sell 83 of these, then you have to go and ask the question, can I raise my price? If so, how much? What it would be realistic? You can even, a lot of people actually in small businesses, we do the thing, okay, realistically, how many can I sell in a day with the foot traffic that goes by? You might say, okay, I could probably realistically sell 40. And then you could say, all right, if with a break even of 40, let me walk my way back through to see what that would mean for the price of each one. See what I mean about that? So if you wanted to do it the backwards way, you could say, all right, I can sell 40 baskets. I can sell 40 baskets, realistically. Okay, in that case, then I would have $125 over price minus $2.50 equals 40. See what I mean? You can back in. What price would I have to charge to do that? And in a case like this, doing some algebra, 125 is 40 times P minus 250 cents. Okay, that would be 125 equals 40P minus 100. So 25 equals 40P. My ass. What am I doing wrong here? 40? Huh? Did I do something? What did I do? Yeah. See, I wanted to make sure you saw that could happen in here. 225. That's good. I'm proud of you for seeing that because usually I have to tell you that was what I did wrong. But I so suck at math. Divided by 40. $5.63. $5.63. That would be to sell 40 and break even. That would mean you would go home with no profit. So that, at least, that gives you a baseline price where you, what sometimes I call my get real price, is $5.63 means that I go home with no loss but no profit. And then I say, okay, let's talk price. Okay, $5.63 is the minimum that I can charge. Now let's see what I can charge. So in this case, this tells me my base, and then I figure, okay, I can probably pull $6, $7, $7.50. This is where you do it. You just start working your way up, say, okay, this is the minimum I have to do. If I can sell 40 baskets, this is the minimum price I'd have to charge to come home with no money. If I want to eat at Denny's tonight, I'll have to charge more than that. So then you say, all right, let's put a tag on them, just realistically, what I do. I put a tag on it, say $8. See what the foot traffic does. Give myself about 30 minutes of foot traffic. Okay, I had five sales at $8 in 30 minutes. I'm going to be here for five more hours. That's 10 of those 30 minutes. Eight times. Okay, I sold this many baskets. Five times 10, 50. Yeah, I can do it. That's kind of how you do it on the fly. Just feeling your way along. But anyway, that's break even. And I'm showing you a little more than the book does. How we do it when we're actually cranking out business stuff. The price is the real pain in the butt. We're going to beat our variable costs down as much as we can. But I do want to draw something for you here. Is this function, quantity break even, well, it's actually, where is the thing? There it is. This is actually from your old math days, those dark days when you were doing linear algebra. That's a linear equation. It's one of those things like y equals mx plus b. It's just basically, it's just a fancy way of saying that that the dependent variable, profit, is equal to the variable quantity on the horizontal axis times a slope plus a y-intercept. So in other words, the negative fixed cost is your y-intercept. Right there is the y-intercept at negative FC. And the line has a slope of P minus V. That's the slope, is the P minus V. And the x-intercept is your break-even point. Here's the thing about this. Here's what's kind of important about this in the modern world of business is that you notice that as I incur larger fixed costs, that break-even point gets worse for me. Heavy industries, it takes a lot of production to get to break-even. If you're going to do an industrial kind of company, you've got to make a lot of your product before you're going to crawl out of the hole of your fixed cost. But here's the other part of it too. Notice something interesting is that as I spread P from V more, the slope of my line gets steeper. In other words, as I increase my price against my variable cost per unit, my break even gets shorter, gets tighter, gets closer in. The risk there is, can I actually sell the product like that? There's also another downside to it too. Notice that once I've crossed break even, every unit of sales makes my profit jump lots. Every extra unit I sell, my profit is skyrocketing. But on the other side of that, if my sales are hurt, I go down into hell real fast with a big unit margin. In another era, and even to some extent in our era, you will see some small businesses, like barber shops, where it seemed like how could they possibly make a living, a guy make a living, cutting hair for $5 a cut. The trick with those was that their fixed costs were actually pretty low, and their profit margin, their unit margin was actually very low too. They had very short lines. But what was interesting about them was they had to do a certain number of haircuts every day. But even if they had a bad day, they didn't have a massive loss of profit. And if they had a good day, they had a little bit of profit. But these companies wouldn't grow. They were just a small town thing. But they managed to survive for a long time, even in bad economic times, because that unit margin, the spread between P and V, was small. So any volatility in their sales really didn't have a massive impact on profit. In other words, their degree of combined leverage was low. And that's how these small businesses could survive for so long. Any of you ever go to a Dollar Tree or to a Dollar General? I think they're great. At Christmas time, 10 bucks, 10 gifts. Covered my relatives. Seriously. I mean, and I expect them to buy for me too. I send them my Amazon wish list. But interestingly enough, at a Dollar Tree, think about how difficult it would be for a store that charges a buck for everything to actually survive. How the hell could you do that? Because you've got a store. Everything's a dollar. So in a given day on a given store, your unit margin on sales is probably going to be at best 50 cents. And you might sell 100 items, typical about 250 items per day in a store. With a margin on each one of those of 50 cents, how could you possibly do that? Because you have to pay for a building's lease. It's a cheap building. You always put them in the cheap parts of town, yes. So obviously it's going to be a low fixed cost there. But you also have to pay an employee. You probably have to pay three a day, minimum wage. So that just doesn't make sense how that could function, because you're going to have to pay a light bill, water bill. So essentially at the end of the day, you are just barely breaking even on each store because your net margin is so darn low. You're probably going to be up here somewhere. So your profit is going to be some pathetic number every day. How could you possibly run a company like that? If your profit per store, let's say on a given day, was, let's say, $20, how could that possibly be one of the greatest companies in America? Because you have 5,000 stores. 20 times 5,000 is what? 20 times 5,000 is what? $100,000. Times that by 360 open days a year. Now you see why they do it? They use low net unit margins, but all they do is multiply the low unit margin across a vast number of stores. This is the business model of Dollar Tree, Dollar General, Aldi's. They are the love children of Wall Street because they, even if, suppose you're running the Dollar Tree in Bloomington, Illinois. And of course, you're a slob and the store burns down. You ignorant, you twit. Why did you do that? I don't know, man. I was stoned and I was tired. Aren't you glad I got out? No, you should have burned. God. Okay. One store burns down. What does that do to your overall network profit for the day? Hardly anything. You can be out of business for 3 months, and it barely dents the entire network. So you see, this is one of the most important, popular business models. Instead of going for the Hail Mary, the wide P minus V on one store, what you do is go for narrow P minus V on a network of thousands of stores. And then you make not only a lot of money, but you are also gaining that low risk of a low leverage risk. The low risk, low leverage, low risk, I should say. Because each one of your units has low risk, little profit, but across the network that creates an insanely large profit. But how could you possibly, only one of my managers is an idiot. It's you. No one else's store burned down today. So what do you have to say for yourself? Sorry? Want a Kit Kat? Or what? I don't know. But you see, that would be the distributed risk means that what would happen to one store wouldn't happen to any other stores. So the low margin, you will earn $20. That's all I lost in profit every day by your store burning down. You see the idea? So in business, it's not so much, almost never is it the Hail Mary that makes for the insanely great, wealthy business people, those geniuses and all that that are the rich multimillionaires. It's actually usually the old, what we used to call the old Woody Hayes strategy for the Ohio State football team. Don't throw passes. Just do 3 yards in a cloud of dust on each play, and you'll get to the goal line one time after another time after another time. And that's the moral of the story here, is that don't go for a lot wide leverage. Go for low leverage, and then just multiply that low leverage across a network of stores. Some of the great wealthy people of our time were the candy, little trinket candy manufacturers, trinket toys, trinkets for the home, because they could sell millions of them distributed across thousands and thousands of stores, and so they became millionaires, not by the grand slam, but by the 3 yards in a cloud of dust. That's all I have for you. Thank you.